Last year, over 13,000 people were reported missing in New York City. Most are found in a day or two, and most missing persons are not as prominent as Dorothy Arnold, an heiress from a fabulously wealthy Manhattan family. Maybe you've heard of her, or maybe not, because Dorothy Arnold went missing in 1910, and her case is the longest still open missing person case in New York City.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Weird World Podcast. I'm Carrie.
I'm Dean.
And we're going to talk about a missing person.
We are a good old-fashioned disappeared person.
Good old-fashioned?
Yeah, you know, we do a fair number of disappeared cases.
I know, but it's not missing good. Person.
No, they're not good. My they're rarely point. Good. I guess it depends on the person. This one, though, is one of the oldest ones out there that's never been solved. Almost certainly at this point never will be solved. You never know, though.
Well,
maybe you at home can solve it with us. we're not going to solve it. And we're going to solve this case, or more likely not solve this case, in two parts. First, here in part one, right now, we're going to give you some background on Dorothy and take you through her whole day, step by step, of what happened to her. And then also when she fell off the face of the earth and a little bit of the investigation also in that began when her family started looking for Dorothy Arnold. I mean, a little bit of background first. In 2023, over 13,000 people were reported missing in the five boroughs that make up New York City, as I teased. You can report someone missing immediately, by the way, in New York. You don't have any, 48 hours or 72-hour waiting period.
No. Yeah.
If you think someone's missing, you have a good reason for that, you can report it right away.
I wonder if that's really any kind of rule.
I think anywhere, a lot of times it's not.
Yeah.
And I think some of the times it is. And you get it that a lot of times, the vast majority of cases are just someone who's temporarily misplaced and there's been some kind of a misunderstanding or, a runaway, something like that. New York City local officers from the local precinct or whatever will handle the case initially. But if it drags on for kind of informally a few weeks, then they turn it over to the famed NYPD's missing persons squad, which is in charge of, thousands and thousands of cases that are still on their books.
I didn't know they were famous.
You never heard of the missing persons squad?
Well,
New York City Police Department? Huh. I am shocked, Carrie. Shocked.
I mean, in real life, no.
Okay. But in your fake life, yes.
TV movies, probably, okay. Sure.
Well, they're real. The missing persons.
I've also heard of the Special Victims Unit.
Yes. There's lots of those.
Well, specifically.
We've also heard of CSIs in soon every city in the country and some other countries too. Eventually, they'll run out of American countries to have the cities to have the CSI in.
I'm surprised they don't. I'll bet you they do.
CSI Acapulco. Mm. I'm just throwing that out there. The missing person squad promises to continue searching for someone until they can close the case with some level of certainty. The vast majority of cases, as I mentioned, are resolved within a couple of days. Like, just some teen who made a bad decision, didn't want to come home right away, or very often an elderly family member who's wandered off and then you find them. So that's why they take them pretty seriously, especially given whatever the circumstances are. And most are runaways, are adults who left of their own free will. But the oldest missing person case still in the books in New York City's missing person squad is not some, just nameless person that's quickly forgotten. She was really from a very prominent family in the city. She was a socially active Manhattan rich girl who disappeared while on Fifth Avenue shopping trip in the middle of the day with about $1,000 in today's money in her muff, her hand warmer, on a shopping spree.
There a pocket inside that hand warmer?
There must be, because they said she carried other things. We'll get to it. But
yeah,
she put her money in that muff, but she also a box of chocolates. I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah, they did that.
Huh.
It's 1910, and she's dressed in New York City's social finest.
It could be one of those ones, because I've seen them, that they kind of hang down.
They may.
It's not just wide enough to encase your hands.
I think we have a picture of it.
Or
a drawing of what she's wearing on the day she disappeared. We'll put that on our social media. Her name is Dorothy Harriet Camille Arnold. We'll call her Dorothy. And her case is kind of legendary, in part for just, the mundaneness of the circumstances. One newspaper would write, "She disappeared from one of the busiest streets on earth at the sunniest hour of a brilliant afternoon with thousands within sight and reach, men and women who knew her on every side, and officers of the law thickly strewn about her path, end quote.
Okay.
Seems like an exaggeration.
Yeah.
She didn't know everybody lived in New York, and there's probably not a cop on every corner, but it really is a situation. She's literally spoke to a friend, and then she disappeared off the face of the earth. In middle of the day, bright sunlight.
Yeah.
No one. No, like, hint. Oh, I saw someone fitting her description. Go this way or that. After she had that last encounter, she's gone. She vanishes, and we'll get to it. But the search for her eventually would be extremely thorough.
Huh. Not to make light of the situation, but the other day I saw somebody vanish right before my very
eyes. No.
Yep.
Did you report this to?
No. Because
anyone, not even me, apparently.
Then I saw this person later on. It's not somebody I know. It's a neighbor.
So they disapparated and then apparated again?
Well,
this neighbor might be a sorcerer.
No, not exactly. But I was driving by and I saw a young man looking like inside of a car window.
Oh, well, intriguing.
You know, he was like standing in the street. And I assume like maybe they locked their keys in the car or something like that. I didn't know who he was, but I wasn't suspicious. It was like, I don't know, 8:30 in the morning or something like that. So I was careful as I drove by because there was a person in the street. And so I drove past him. Mm-hmm. And then I literally immediately glanced in my mirrors and he was not there.
Carrie, that was a car thief and he snuck behind a tree.
There was no tree. That's
the
point.
Behind the car. He flattened the ground, rolled into the car. That nice white lady just saw me about to steal the car. I better be careful.
Nope. And then, because I looked to see.
Or she's going to report me to the police, even though this is my car. I better be careful.
I assumed he was from across the street, the house across the street, not the side of the street that the car was parked on. And where the car was, it was not in right in front of a house. It was kind of the side of a house. So it wasn't like he could have just, in a split second, gone to that house, to the front of that house.
I see.
He would have had to have crossed the street. And I mean, I looked in my mirror immediately. But so then I wasn't.
Do you know who this person is?
No.
It's a ghost.
No.
This is a ghost.
Then when I came back, I saw him walking around the neighborhood, very like around the corner of where this was with a young woman. So I'm assuming this was his girlfriend or something.
No, I'm assuming that they went on a date and they died in a car crash and they're now both haunting our block.
No.
And you've seen these ghosts twice. That's how we're going to play it, Carrie.
I should see if I see that car again.
Carrie, given the nature of our podcast, that's how we're going to play it.
Okay.
Ghost twice. Amazing sight.
But it was weird.
Let's do a podcast.
Where did he go?
That.
And how did he go so fast?
Let's do a different podcast. Today we're doing Dorothy Arnold. So this was a very baffling case to the police to everyone right from the start. Dorothy was a daughter of Francis Rose Arnold. That's a man whose fine goods import company mainly traded in high-end perfume and cologne from Europe. Ton of money, though. Filthy rich. Dorothy was born in 1885. She was the second of four children in this prestigious and wealthy family that they traced their roots all the way back, I think, to the Mayflower. I think through the wife, literally to the Mayflower, which is, you know, a lot of these old rich white people will say, people go back to the Mayflower. So who knows? The mother was named Mary, and she had three other brothers, the oldest one named John. One of Dorothy's uncles, was a former Supreme Court Justice Rufus Peckham.
Never heard of him.
Well, but he's a prominent person. I mean,
very.
In fact, the first New York Times article about said daughter of Peckham strangely disappeared or something like that. She was identified through him. He was, a Supreme Court justice.
But so she was 25.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The Arnolds lived in the posh Upper East Side in a big home on 108 East 79th Street. It's just two or three blocks east of Central Park, but up a ways. Dorothy had graduated from the prestigious Philadelphia area liberal arts school, Bryn Mawr. She graduated in 1905, about 5 years before this. She was a literature major, and she wanted very much to become a writer. So she came back home after college because she didn't have a way of supporting herself. Is back in the day, you went to college and you came home. You came home to get married, basically.
Right.
Your college was to make you cultured. But she was very serious about her literary aspirations. And her dream didn't die. She continued writing. And finally, by 1910, she felt confident enough to send out a short story. So he sent it to McClure's magazine in the spring of 1910. This is a monthly magazine.
Heard of it.
You've heard of McClure's? Uh-huh. Well, they're long gone.
Yeah.
Are you this McClure's? That they well, like, they were gone by 1929.
From the olden days.
Okay. They were actually a great muckraking, investigative journalist kind of a magazine that also published literary fiction in its the early days of them, like this was. They weren't that old by then.
Yeah.
Eventually they'd actually come into financial trouble. The McClure, SS McClure would lose it, and the people who took over turned it into like a women's fashion magazine, and it wasn't near the prestige. But originally they had published some real hard hitting and important investigative journalism. And again, at this time also, high quality fiction, so sent it into McClure's. And sadly, they said no. They rejected it. So, okay, a couple months later, in November of 1910, she sent another story. This one was called The Poinsettia and the Flame. It, too, was rejected. Now, she sort of, I mean, this is a high-end magazine. They're publishing well-known writers. I mean, it's at a time where short stories make you a lot of money.
Yeah.
And but this was just a kind of a crushing blow to Dorothy because her family found out about it and they started relentlessly teasing her.
Like, that's not nice.
No, it's horrible. So she's like just really crestfallen. She wants to find her muse. So she asked her dad, hey, I want you to rent me a little studio apartment in New York's bohemian artsy Greenwich Village. Uh-huh. That's where all the poets and writers and great artists go in New York at the time, probably still is to some degree, although I'm sure it's very trendy. And, and he said, no, if you're a good writer can write anywhere. I'm not paying for an apartment. She did, however, use her allowance of money. She got $100 a month in allowance. She used some of that money to get a P.O. box. So when she, you know, any correspondence, the family didn't have to know about it. It must have been a situation where they found like this, hey, there's a letter for you from McClure's. And I don't know, who knows, one of her brothers probably opened it, teasing her, holding it too high for her to grab. And it was rejection.
So what would $100 be worth today?
Like
$3,300. Oh, okay.
So it was nice. She was, you know, and obviously she's living high on the hog. That's just for spending money. So this is kind of Dorothy's life in December of 1910. She's coddled. She's privileged. But she's also frustrated. And she's really hungry for a kind of a life on her own, doing what she loved to do, which was writing. Her younger sister, Marjorie, is going to have her debutante ball coming up. It was scheduled for the 17th of December. So on December 12th, Dorothy decides, I need to go dress shopping. Got to get a nice dress for my sister's ball. Look great. This is what you did.
Right.
Rich people in New York. That's how you did it. Probably London too. You know.
Really rich people, they bring the dresses to you.
That's a good point. She liked to go. You like to hunt around. She wasn't sure she was going to find what she needed. She told her mom, Mary, and Mary said, well, maybe I could go with you. Because, you know, it's like this, it's a really cold day. There's ice in the streets, even icy sidewalks. Even though it's a bright sun, it's a very cold day. I think the high was 21 degrees Fahrenheit. So, but Dorothy said, no, I'll be fine. Don't worry about me. And Mary, her mom was like, sort of like almost like invalid, kind of. She was just sort of, she really stayed in the house. She always had something wrong with her. But still, she thought, you know, I can go with you if you want. And Dorothy said, no, mother, don't bother. You don't feel just right, and it's no use going to the trouble. I mightn't see a thing I want, but if I do, I'll phone you. End quote. Okay. Just want to give you a little flavor of how they talked back then, apparently. That must have been what her mom said she said. Now, interestingly, she also had apparently told a friend that she was going to go shopping that day with her mom. So it seems like maybe she wasn't in the mood for company because, you know, her friend's not going to come with her. Yeah. She told her, you know, she kind of told two people different things. Sort of maybe so she could be alone. It could be just a complete coincidence. She planned on going with her mom, but then she thought, my mom's going to slow me down. She's going to walk a long ass way, as we'll find out here in a second. So I don't know. Regardless, her mother said she looked very cheerful, happy, completely normal when she left the family's mansion around 11 o'clock that morning. She's dressed for the day in this, you know, the normal, she has this fur, like a fox fur black muff. Again, it probably was long, I guess, because but she slipped her cash in there. She had about $25 to $30 from her monthly allowance that she took with her. They knew she took that with her. She had, however, been out with friends the day before, and she withdrawn $36 from her savings so they can go to lunch at Sherry's. I'm sure you know the place. It's a very nice restaurant. And see a matinee. So she had what was left from that as well. So $25 to $30 plus whatever is left from having lunch and a matinee, yeah, even a nice restaurant. She had a good chunk of change on her. Let's say even if it's just as low as $35 or $40, if you're a fan of the show, you know that's probably worth something like $7 trillion in today's money.
No, but it would be worth like $1,000.
It'd be worth $7 trillion, Gary. I'm pretty clear about that.
Okay.
Or if you want the truth, it is worth something like $1,150 to about $1,320 in today's money. It depends on how you want to tell the story. I choose $7 trillion. You can choose $1,200, $1,300 on her. Okay. Still, you can get a pretty nice dress for that. And what do you know, an allowance for a rich girl, $3,300 a month. Huh. That's not bad.
No, not
especially at all.
Especially
she's not paying for, you know, tip relief food and stuff like that. She eats at home.
She doesn't have to pay any bills with
it. Yeah, no bills, nothing. Not bad. Yeah. So she starts her hike, and it is a hike. This is what people did back then. They walked everywhere. They walked distances that people nowadays would just go, I don't think so, as they waited at the subway station for the train.
Well, they also took cabs and stuff.
She did not. She walked. So the first part of this journey from 108 East 79th Street, she went to her first stop, or at least where she was seen, was a place called Park and Tilford, a candy store on 5th Avenue and 59th Street. It's literally at the immediate southeast corner of Central Park. So imagine the long rectangle going north to south, that is Central Park. Look at the lower right. A kitty corner to that is Park and Tilford. It's a very famous candy store.
Okay, I have a question for you.
Yes.
Remember when we went to New York and we stayed right at one end of Central Park?
Mm-hmm. The southern.
That was the southern end? So that's where she was?
That's exactly where she was. She lived. Remember we walked all the way up to the museum and went up the Upper East Side? That's roughly where she lived. So she's now walking all of the way, I think even further than we went. In fact, I'm sure
that's a long walk.
It's a very long walk. It's about 1.2 miles. Yeah. All along, you'd probably walk along the eastern edge of Central Park the entire way over these kind of icy sidewalks on this very, very cold, freezing day. So, but still, that's nothing to most people.
Yeah.
Especially New Yorkers. She bought a half pound of chocolates at Park and Tilford, and she charged them to the family account. So it's not like she's trying to be hidden. That'll come up later when you think about theories. She says, Dorothy Arnold, put it on my family. Give me a half a pound of chocolate. And that was, according to the clerks there, about noon that she finally left after. And we'll have a picture of the candy store. It looks just like you'd think it does with these all these glass things. It looks just like a candy store does nowadays, just maybe a little nicer. It's funny. So it's not like she's being super careful or super secretive. And she was leaving about noon. I don't know how long she's at Park and Tilford, but still, she left 11 o'clock and went 1.2 miles to Park and Tilford. Unless she was hunting around for those chocolates for a very long time, that seems really slow, doesn't it? 1.2 miles to take you, I don't know, 25, 30 minutes max, don't you think?
It
says in Google Walk, on Google Maps for walking, it's like 27 minutes or something like that. And
yeah.
And they're usually at a kind of a slow pace. If you're walking briskly, you can do that better than that. Is she being super careful? I don't know. I feel like there's a decent chance she stopped somewhere else on the way there and just wasn't seen. Maybe I don't know what would have been.
Maybe she took a stroll through the park.
She could have.
And, you know, you could be stopping along the way when you come across people you know or
for
whatever.
Sure. I thought about that, but again, there's going to be a massive search for her. Everybody
people
who saw
say,
her
yeah.
said so, and lots of people did so. If she stopped at a friend, I don't think so. If she walked through Central Park alone and just dipped into the park and walked around, sure.
Yeah.
But if she stopped anywhere else, I think it would have been known.
Yeah.
Regardless, she stuffed the box of chocolates into her muff, and she headed south again. Her next stop, at least where people did remember seeing her and said so, was at Brentano's bookstore.
Oh, goodness.
Very famous chain of, eventually chain of bookstore. This was the famous Manhattan where it all started from, Brentano's bookstore.
Not sure they still exist today.
I don't think bookstores do as a general rule. This was on 5th and 27th Street. So that's another 22 blocks or about 1.6 miles, according to Google Maps now.
Yeah.
So that's over 50 blocks, and it's not that far under 3 miles. So damn, girl. Apparently, this was like that's all her exercise was through walking, which is probably true for any young lady at the time. At Brentano, she bought a book called Engaged Girl Sketches. I think it was like one source said it was like romantic, you know, over the top kind of whim stuff. One source said it was like humorous sketches of things. So maybe it was humorous romantic sketches. I don't know. The writer was Emily Calvin Blake. I never heard of her. Staff at Brentano's said that, again, Dorothy seemed fine. She seemed normal. She seemed in very good spirits. Nothing out of the ordinary at all. So she stepped out of Brentano's, and then she ran into a very good friend of hers named Gladys King. Gladys had been invited to Marjorie's upcoming ball. So they started chatting about that. And then Gladys mentioned, and by the way, I have my RSVP right here. I was going to go mail it. Can you take it for me and bring it to your mom? And she joked about, hey, you're saving me postage. Thank you so much. That's very nice. So she took it. Dorothy did. And she left Brentano's. Presumably heading north and heading home, or at least toward home. And she said something about, yeah, I'm going to head home now. I'm going to take a walk through Central Park.
Wait, she hasn't gone dress shopping yet, has she?
That's a great question. As far as I can tell, she had not stepped one foot into a dress shop.
Huh.
Unless... Okay. She did so in between that time. It's hard to say.
Oh, between the candy shop and the bookstore?
I think so, because this is now about 2 p.m., so she had plenty of time.
Oh,
again,
yeah.
If she did so without being waited on or seen by staff, which seems odd. You think they'd jump at the first sight of this rich young lady and how can I help you, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it seems even weirder, though, if they would not have remembered her after the fact when there was blanket coverage of
remember
this event.
That she tried on a dress and didn't buy it or whatever.
Or even just shopped or window shopped and just didn't see anything she liked. It's hard to say. So she might have, but if she did go dress shopping on this day where she said she's going to dress shopping, it's no one remembered her at a dress shop.
I could go shopping and people wouldn't remember me.
You
in the
could
store.
But Carrie, you're I not am. Dorothy Arnold. All right. Actually, she probably looked like any other rich girl. This is on Fifth Avenue. So
no, I know,
she could have
but,
gone
but
unnoticed.
Like you said, if she's going into Saks or something, the sales girls are gonna be noticing and trying to help her.
Probably a lot of them are salesmen.
Yeah.
But
not for dresses. Dude.
Oh, I bet they would have been.
No.
Back in the area.
They're gonna help her.
Mm-hmm.
Button. Mm-hmm. They're going to help her with the back zipper.
Let me loosen your bustle.
Yeah. No.
It's a euphemism back in the day. Trust me. I have no idea. So if she did dress her up, she certainly seems like she had the time to. Because again, Gladys, her friend, said when we said goodbyes outside Brentano's, it was about 2 o'clock.
Yeah.
So it had been another couple of hours since she had left the candy shop. That mile, that 1.6 miles, even going slowly though, it seems like that would have been probably 40 minutes or something like that. So that leaves her an hour and 20 minutes to hang out at Brentano's. That's not impossible.
No.
She could have been, maybe she walked even slower. So it's possible she didn't really even go dress shopping. So who knows? And yet another person, Gladys, said she was great. She was fine. She was laughing. She was in good spirits. She seemed completely normal. So they parted there on 27th Street. And Gladys headed down towards the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. She's going to meet her mother for lunch. She remembers that it was 2 p.m. because that was when she was supposed to be there at the Waldorf and meet her mom. So she goes, oh, I'm late. I better, you know, get going.
Uh-huh.
And she waves goodbye. And then she crosses the street and she turned around one more time. And so did Dorothy. They waved again. Dorothy going north. Gladys going south. Gladys rushes across the street. And that was the last time anyone ever saw Dorothy Arnold again for all time. No witness after this accidental encounter with a friend was ever found that saw Dorothy. It was literally as if she walked through one of the biggest cities in the world in broad daylight along crowded streets into oblivion.
Yeah.
No, I mean, absolutely no hint of anything that happened after leaving Brentano's. And it's still... you know, a good, decent walk, a long walk before she even gets to Central Park. But no one came forward to say they had seen her before she got to Central Park, if she ever did.
I think she was abducted off the street.
We'll see. So,
I don't think we will.
Maybe you're not. Okay. Well, we'll theorize at least, put it that way. Again, one thing that you mentioned is that seems odd is that she didn't go dress shopping. She didn't appear to have stopped in any dress shops. That's a little bit interesting. Just keep that in the back of your mind, I guess. The family, though, didn't get that worried early on as the day, you know, she seemed like, okay, she's a little late getting back from dress shopping. Maybe she found something nice. Dress shopping can take a while. You got to get out of a lot of stuff and get into a lot of stuff. It's not easy.
Yeah.
Believe me, I know.
Especially in 1910.
Oh my God.
Believe you don't know.
It must have been horrific.
Uh-huh.
But by kind of the early evening, the Arnolds are starting to wonder what became of their daughter. And then at dinner time, everything says dinner time, doesn't say when exactly was that. Was it 6 o'clock? Was it 7 o'clock? Was it 8 o'clock? People ate later then.
Yeah.
So it's probably, let's just say it was 7 or 8 or even could have been 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
But by dinner time, and she's not there, they are kind of officially worried because Dorothy would just literally had never done that.
Yeah.
If she was going to miss a meal because she's out with friends or something like that, she always would have called her parents. She ate at home all her meals typically every single day. It was just immediate to the family. It's like, something's wrong. She should be here. She knows it's dinner time. So her mom, Mary, was very concerned. And she, and maybe her brothers too, I don't know, started phoning all of the friends of Dorothy that they could think of. And, you know, have you seen Dorothy? Have you heard anything about her? Did you see her anytime during the day? Every call they made to these friends ended in a dead end. No one had seen Dorothy. So I guess that means they hadn't talked to Gladys King. That wasn't one of the persons. I don't know how super close of a friends
right.
they were, but they hadn't called Gladys. Gladys at least could have given them a hint at this early stage.
Yeah.
But everybody said, no, haven't seen her, didn't see her today at all. Each call, though, from Mary Frances ended with the same request, which was, oh, by the way, would you mind ever so much not mentioning this call to anyone? Just, you know.
Why?
I mean, it's like, sure, she's fine. She'll probably be back to tell the tale. Just don't mention that we can't find her right now. You'll see.
Okay.
But, it's scandal. I mean, they were trying very hard to avoid any kind of a hint of a scandal. Because even in this early stage, there had to be, and we'll find out why later, there had to be a suspicion that she had gone off with someone.
Right. Okay. A boy.
Sure. Okay. If you want to call him that.
Man.
When Elsie Henry, who was one of the friends that the Arnolds had called back later, right around midnight, and said, hey, what happened? Did you ever get a hold of Dorothy? Mary Frances said, quote, yes, she's here, end quote. So naturally, Elsie says, oh my God, that's so amazing. Let me talk to her. We have so much to catch up on. Mrs. Arnold said, oh, no. She had a headache after dinner and she went to bed, which is, of course, a lie. She's still missing. So that leads you to believe that, you know, they probably suspected what I said, that she had gone off with someone, that she was safe, but just being a very, right. very bad girl. And they were really desperately trying to avoid scandal. That was a big deal back then.
Very, very bad 25-year-old woman.
Yes, I know. That's
with a college
weird.
Education.
Yeah. A grown-ass woman, college educated, but she's treated like a girl. Uh-huh. And they
Well, just, I mean, I would be worried if my 25-year-old didn't come home.
Sure, but would you be...
No.
Would you end every call with, don't tell anyone?
No.
No, you say, tell everyone.
Yes.
So the family awoke, and the next morning, still no Dorothy. So over breakfast, they decided, we've got to do something. So, I mean, they called the police, right?
No, I'm guessing not.
They should not have. Yeah. Well, okay, they didn't call the police. They called like a professional private detective, like maybe the famous Pinkerton agency? Uh-uh. Wrong again. They are absolutely obsessed with this whole, no one needs to know about this kind of thing. Remember, your daughter is missing. It's the next day now. She's been gone for close to 24 hours at this point. So
this, by the way, is another reason why rich people suck.
Sure.
Because appearances mean more.
Yeah, especially at this time.
Than a loved one.
Especially with a socially prominent New York upper crust kind of family. And that kind of milieu, it's a huge deal. So instead, John, Dorothy's oldest brother, said, hey, I have this lawyer friend of mine. His name is John S. Keith. And he's a junior partner with the Manhattan law firm of Garvin Armstrong. And hey, I think he should look into this. And he's kind of like, he's both a family friend and he's a young lawyer who would dearly love to ingratiate himself with the very wealthy and important Francis Arnold. So I think the reason is like, as a family friend and a young lawyer who's going to kiss her ass, he is going to keep quiet about this. He won't go blabbing. You know, he can be trusted. He can be discreet.
Well, if they're hiring him, he has to be.
Yes, I know, but still, he's not some prominent lawyer, or even, like I said, the Pinkertons at this point. So, and it's, you know, this might seem a little callous to you, but there's a little bit of historical context that these decisions make a little more sense. Obviously, you know, they're being very self-centered, they're being very class conscious, but there was a recent case where kind of a family had been really almost ruined by kind of a similar case that resulted in scandal. It was the previous year, and a 13-year-old girl named Adele Boas disappeared while walking through Central Park.
Yeah.
So the family did what you would think they do nowadays. They called the police immediately. They were scared. A massive search ensued. It turned up nothing. They think the worst. Not long later, they find her in Boston, and she had run off of her own free will with a man.
A 13-year-old?
Yeah, I know. Well, Carrie.
OMG.
That happens every day nowadays.
I think a legitimate concern would be fake ransom calls.
Yeah.
Fake ransom demands.
Yeah. That's not their main reason. It was for serious scandal. So, but this did result in a huge scandal for the Boas family. They were also an Upper East Side family. They lived not that far, and they were just vilified and scandalized by the press.
Yeah.
And they just took a hit. I don't know if they stopped being invited to parties or something like that, but they really, it was a big scandal. They were hugely embarrassed and scandalized. So given that about a year before, the Arnold family is thinking that's going to happen to us. If she just did something stupid, let's keep it on the down low. So you might ask yourself, oh, well, how about the police? Couldn't the police be discreet? But, you know, this is, the Arnolds are this WASP, old money family, upper class, kind of things like that. The New York Police Department at the time would have been viewed as a bunch of, like, honestly, drunk Irish immigrants, super corrupt, probably really inept. I mean, there's been this kind of class tension between rich people in London. It happened too early on because a lot of the police were hired from barely working class kind of environments.
Yeah.
And in New York, a lot of them really were Irish immigrants, and a lot of them really were corrupt and inept. Yeah. So they thought the police aren't going to be any help anyway, and all they're going to do is blab about it. You know, they decided they didn't. So it's kind of both this idea of keeping the story private, and because they may have thought they would get a better result, they had John Keith do this instead, do this investigation. So they took him up into the house and they said, okay, go look in her bedroom, see what you can see. So he did, and he goes up there with them, and he thoroughly searches her bedrooms for any kind of clues. And they look in her closet, and they see all these clothes and her cases, like suitcases and stuff like that, and really any personal belongings that she had are there. Her mom says, yeah, as far as I can tell, all of her clothes are here. And I saw her walk out the door.
Right.
She had what she was wearing and her muff, and that's it.
Yeah.
So she didn't, it wasn't like she was, you know, I mean, who knows? She could have pre-staged it somehow. But
she could have tossed it out the window.
She could have, or left it somewhere safe. I don't know, who knows, where, with a friend or something like that.
Well, then it really would have had to have been planned.
Yeah. If something like that, but as Mary Frances says, it looks like all her clothes are there.
Yeah.
And she left with nothing but the literally clothes on her back.
If I looked in any of our kids' closets, I would have no idea.
Really? I know.
I don't know what. Yeah. Know.
But back then, you know, you didn't have, even rich people had a, right? They didn't have just, they probably had far less clothes than we do now because you wore the same thing often over and over and over again because, you know, you didn't have the throwaway clothes we have now, the fast fashion.
Correct.
So I it was probably pretty thorough that Mary Frances said she didn't she didn't take anything. They looked in her desk. They looked in her desk drawer, and there Keith found this like a clutch of personal letters. Some, by the way, with foreign postmarks. There were also two folders that had like transatlantic ocean steamship kind of information, little like packets for, like, you're going to sail overseas to Europe or something like that. Oh. So they start thinking, oh, my God, more evidence. Was she planning to run off to Europe and maybe meet somebody there or with somebody?
Did her family know anything about her?
No, they did not.
Getting that,
but who knows? It could have just been, who knows?
Yeah.
Could have been some planning for some, I mean, women like that, their family sent them off to Europe all the time. Chaperoned, of course.
Yeah.
But it's not unheard of. Or it's not that weird that she was thinking about taking a trip to Europe. I'm sure if she asked her dad would have sent her gladly.
No, I don't think it's weird at all. But I was just curious.
Yeah, they didn't. Apparently they did not know that she was. So they looked down a little suspiciously when they found those.
Yeah.
But Keith wasn't done. He's very thorough. So he gets down on his hands and knees and he starts poking through the fireplace that was in Dorothy's room. And there he found this little kind of a pile of papers. They're pretty badly burned, but he brought them out. And the family said, oh, you know what? I bet she's burned her latest manuscript that got rejected or something like that. Keith said he looked a little closer and he started, you know, like scratching his finger and he couldn't see any writing on the charred remains of them. So we don't know what those papers were.
Yeah.
Could they have been letters that she's burning? Could they have been a manuscript? Could they have been something just, you know, she's writing something, whatever, and she tosses a letter that she decided not to send? Who knows?
Yeah.
It's a little, so it's a little bit suggestive of what he found up there, you know, especially those transatlantic packets of information, but no clues about where she is. Keith is undeterred, though. He's a little go-getter. Again, he wants to make Francis his client, I have no doubt. So he says, I'm going to do whatever it takes. I'm going to find her for you. I'm going to check every hospital. I'm going to check morgues. I'm even going to check jails for any sign of Dorothy. If she can be found, I'm going to find her, and we won't bring in the police, I promise you. So he spent the next weeks, several weeks, personally going to morgues in the city, going to hospitals, going to jails, not just New York. He also went to Boston. He went to Philadelphia. You know, where would a young rich girl go like that? If you're not on your way to Europe, that's the places you go. So he's checking everywhere. He's coming up empty. Like, can you imagine you're looking at the, I don't know, a Jane Doe corpse fished from a river. And so, you know, in a chill box, I don't know if they had chill boxes then, but wherever the morgues kept them, you're checking every, you know, pulling down the sheet and looking at the face. Nope, that's not her. You're walking through hospital aisles. I guess if they have an unnamed patient who's injured or something like that, you've got to go take a look at him, see if that's Dorothy. And again, all over New York, Philadelphia and Boston, God, jails too.
Yeah.
Oh, here's some drunk woman. We don't know her name. Is that her? Nah, that's not her. She's just sleeping off a binge. So he was, you know, a tenacious investigator. But remember, he's a young lawyer. He's not what he's trained to do.
Yeah.
So nothing comes of it, though. No sign of Dorothy. And again, as I stressed earlier, there's nothing after Brentano's, and she had to have. She had a long walk, almost 3 mile walk ahead of her to get home. And again, almost half that was just to get to Central Park, maybe more than that.
And it was two-ish in the afternoon.
Bright sunny day. People crowded across every sidewalk.
But what I was going to say is it's December, probably.
Still, there's hours. Yeah, she's easily home before it's daylight.
Yes.
Easily. Or before it's nighttime.
Unless it takes her 3 hours.
No. So he can't find any hint of her whatsoever. He finally just admits defeat. I can't do it. I'm sorry. I promise I would. I'm not able to. I've done the best I can, but I'm not a detective. So he knew the family would continue to resist calling the official police, the NYPD. So he said, why don't we bring in the heavy hitters, the Pinkertons? This is what they do. It's been weeks now, though. But, you know, that's an agency that was used to working for the rich and powerful and keeping their secrets. So finally, Francis Arnold said, okay, let's call the Pinkertons. So Keith probably arranged that and called him for him. And the Pinkertons got in the case. They sent agents out. Basically, it sounds like to essentially repeat what Keith had done, but much more thoroughly with multiple agents. They did the same thing. They went to hospitals, went to morgues, went to jails. But they cast their net even wider. They talked and they went to, I don't know if Keith did this or not, but the Pinkertons went and found out who does she know? And they talked to every friend and acquaintance of Dorothy and grilled them about their memories. They're now a little bit stale memories, but grilled them about if they had seen her or anything, or any hint of what she was thinking. They even talked to former college classmates, everybody they can, because they have lots of people to go, you know, this dragnet and conduct interviews, but nothing came of this effort either. So they took a look at those transatlantic ocean liner packets and they wondered, okay, maybe she had eloped overseas. Which, again, I, as we'll see later, the family thought might be true very early on.
Yeah.
But they were being pretty secretive about it. So they checked marriage records to see if maybe she got married and then went overseas with the man. I don't know if like you can't pretend to be married on the ocean liner, but they checked marriage records, found nothing. At least she didn't use her own name. they contacted the major ocean liner firms, and they even sent agents to some of the major European seaports, and they would check passengers as they got off steamers from New York City, which seems weird given that the time elapsed. If she was going to Europe, she'd been in Europe for a long time.
Yeah.
They were well behind her, so I'm not sure why that. I think possibly just so Frances Arnold can pay for free trips to Europe.
Yeah.
I'm not even kidding, because that seems like a stupid tactic. But regardless, same thing. They found no evidence that she had gone to Europe, that she had been in any ocean liner heading to Europe.
Yeah.
They found nothing.
Well, passports were a thing back then.
Yeah. She would have had to use her real passport, yeah. You'd think. And
they would know,
yeah.
Presumably, where her passport was kept at home.
Yeah. And so she would have had to use her real name. The ocean, all the steamship services, whatever, the lines, whatever, didn't have any record of Dorothy Arnold going overseas.
And they would know if her passport was missing.
I would think so, too. Yeah, you're right. So the Pinkertons then did something that I'm going to assume pissed off Frances Arnold. They sent out a circular with a highly, even, I'm going to say, freakishly detailed description of Dorothy on her last day to every police force in New York, and then quickly after that, throughout the whole country.
Yeah.
On the circular, they offered a $1,000 reward. I'm sure, what's his name? Frances said, yeah, I'll do that. Which would be, I think, about $33,000 in today's money. So a decent chunk of change. Not a massive reward. He probably wouldn't be a billionaire, but he'd be a very wealthy, you know, worth hundreds of millions of dollars or something like that now. So it seems like, I don't know, he would have a little more than $33,000 in today's money, you would think.
Yeah.
But still, $1,000 reward. Here's exactly what she looked like, exactly what she was wearing. They thought, okay, this is the best way to dig up something on Dorothy. And again, but now it's kind of gone public. And the New York Police Department must have seen the circular. They must have even received the circular. But their protocol was to not do anything about it until a family said, our family member is missing.
Right.
So even with the circular, they did nothing. They didn't lift a finger to go look for Dorothy quite yet. Finally, both John Keith and the Pinkerton agents are just pleading with and almost demanding that Frances call in the official police. But he, for two or three more days after that circular went out, he said no.
And how long had it been by this point?
Well, he finally asked the NYPD for their official help on January 22nd, 1911.
Oh my gosh.
So that's well over 5 weeks, almost 6 weeks.
Yeah.
He waited. So at first
that's
it's John
terrible.
Keith for a few weeks. Then it's the Pinkertons for not that long, for a couple more weeks at most, I guess. And then finally, almost 6 weeks after their daughter has been missing, they bring in the police.
Yeah, although I would expect probably would the Pinkertons be just as competent, if not more, than the police?
Probably, especially for something like that, because
the
police have lots of things to do. The Pinkertons,
right.
they're on your case. But the police also have far more resources and connections than the Pinkertons do. So, and it's you know, good to have them. They can.
Yeah, but the question would be whether or not they're going to use them.
What do you mean? Oh, use the resources? Well,
yeah.
We know what police departments generally do. They do service the very wealthy.
Well, and that's what I was going to say too. But it's also so late.
Yeah,
now.
I know.
The
first 48 hours is important. Well,
if you had come to us, you know, a month and a half ago.
Yeah.
So
they took the case, they got involved, but soon Frances would, I think, kind of probably regret doing this and bringing in the police. Because the police urged Frances to hold a press conference. We got to get the word out there.
Yeah.
Let the newspapers do our job for us. And so, you know, kind of this plea for public help would be their best chance of bringing in leads. So, again, he refused. He said no for a couple more days. He said no, absolutely not. And then finally on January 25th, he said okay. And he called in the press to his office. Again, prominent people can do that. You don't go to them, they go to you.
Yeah.
So he literally his office. He sat behind his desk and called in the press. So this big throng of reporters is crowding around inside, I'm sure, his very spacious office in Manhattan as he sits behind his desk with, you know, pencils flying across their notebooks. And he told this group of reporters about, you know, my daughter disappeared December 10th of last year. I'm offering a $1,000 reward for information that helps find Dorothy. And he then described her, said she's about 5'4", she weighs 140 pounds. She's a pretty brunette with a, quote, full pompadour beneath her stylish velvet hat. And I think this is, you know, she had this navy blue dress on, et cetera. I'll tell you more about that circular because, in fact, I'll do so now. The circular they released, we have to put a picture of this on the social media because it has this like drawing of Dorothy. And again, it's insanely detailed. It's like every little item of clothing and accessories, they list it and underline, and then they have a like a line snaking down to point that out on her person. It's
That's
weird. You know, like that, the weird looking patient on the Operation game is like that on steroids because there's a lot of things they're pointing out that she was wearing. It's the, here's her navy blue serge suit. Oh, and look, here's the high neck with a white lace jabot. It's like a ruffle or something like that. Look, here's her tan gloves, arrow going to her hands. Here's her black fox fur muff, her black velvet hat. They even pointed out her lapis lazuli teardrop earrings with the line going to her ears, the gold tryst lover's knot ring that she wore, and an imitation tortoise shell comb, and a carved barrette, and more. That's weird, right?
Yes.
It looks like a fashion magazine thing or something. It's very strange, but it's super thorough and detailed. So if you saw someone who's a brunette wearing lapis lazuli and a blue dress, you're going to call somebody. So then Francis Arnold said something very, very strange. He told the reporters from every newspaper in the city who he had just told, here's my daughter, I've got a reward out for her. Now, at the end of what he thought was the end of this interview, he said, by the way, I'm absolutely positive that my daughter is dead.
Oh.
I think she had walked through Central Park, and that just like Gladys says she's going to do, and she was killed. Quote, assuming that she walked up home through Central Park, she could have taken the lonely walk along the reservoir. There, because of the laxity of police supervision over the park, I believe it quite possible that she might have been murdered by garroters and her body thrown into the lake or the reservoir. Such atrocious things do happen, though there seems to be no justification for them, end quote. Garroting, by the way, had become a overall slang term for what we now call mugging. It originally meant literally strangulation.
Right.
But it's funny, I have a weird bit to talk about the London garroting panic of the 1850s and 60s where people, because it was one of the things muggers would do is one would get behind you and they would choke you out with some kind of a wire or something or even their arm and their confederate would, you know, steal your stuff and then they'd ditch you. But it then became generalized to mean kind of mugging with the violence.
Yeah.
So he thought she was mugged by muggers and they'd killed her and tossed her in the reservoir in Central Park.
Okay. But then wouldn't her body be found eventually?
We'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay.
We'll get to that. Francis, though, wasn't done. He had, you know, gone public like Keith and the Pinkertons had told him to and offered the reward. I'm not sure why. So he says this. He tells the police, I think my daughter's dead. But then he states, he makes a statement and says, okay, that's it. We're done here. Press conference over. That's not how the press works. So the journalists immediately just start clamoring for more information. They shout out questions at him. Francis is immediately irritated, like, you don't treat me like this. But they wouldn't let up. They're demanding answers. Questions. Kind of a central line of the questioning was, hey, couldn't Dorothy be still alive? Maybe she ran off for some reason of her own free accord.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe she had eloped with some secret lover. And I guess it was known because they said, since you, Francis, the father, forbid her to see men socially. And Francis got all ruffled by this. He was very not pleased. He denied that accusation. Quote, I would have been glad to see her associate more with young men than she did, especially some young men of brains and position, one whose profession or business would keep him occupied. I don't approve of young men who have nothing to do. Uh-oh. Hmm. That last statement seems a little too specific.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is probably when John Keith, I'm assuming is there, is like frantically trying to signal, shut up, walk away, get out of this thing, stop talking. But it's too late. The implication was kind of obvious to all these intrepid reporters. They could read between those lines. The jig was kind of up.
Yeah.
the storybook the next day of the disappearance of Dorothy Arnold. It splashed all across the front pages of all the cities at the time, tons of newspapers.
And this is 6 weeks-ish?
6 weeks, yeah.
After?
January. I guess it would have been January 20. You know, I saw one with I could have sworn it was published on January 11th, so I'm not positive, but they said the press conference was January 25th. So sometime in January, I think about 6 weeks.
Okay.
It started, and it spread nationwide, by the way. This was a national story. Even got, I think, some international press, like an international mystery. So this, I mean, young and pretty Manhattan heiress of this wealthy family, she disappears from the streets of one of the busiest cities in the world in the middle of the afternoon. You can see how, and she's been gone 6 weeks now. There's no sign of her, no hint whatsoever. I mean, imagine that today. It would suffocate the media for weeks. It'd be wall-to-wall coverage. So, and it was. So Frances was said to be, quote, prostrated with grief and worry. End quote. Mary, his wife, was said to be, quote, on the verge of a nervous collapse. I'm sure they had no idea if any of those things are true. This is like the newspapers were pretty terrible then. They're worse now. But the New York media had no problem speculating wildly. And this, they even openly said, she's run off with the man. She's run off with the mystery man or things like that. So because that was kind of their working theory given the end of that press conference.
Right.
But they also thought, like, okay, maybe she was mugged. Maybe she committed suicide. There are lots of possibilities. And they speculated about all of them without any compunction whatsoever. But most of the press thought that was unlikely. They really focused on this thing that she had ran off of somebody.
Yeah.
So the New York Times said, quote, there is no trace of insanity in the family. And the young woman had never shown signs of a troubled mind, although she was devoted to books and spoke several languages. End quote. Almost implies an appreciation for literature and foreign languages is some kind of vice.
Yeah.
Although, but they said, no. She didn't commit suicide in their mind. She ran off. The police probably also, it seems that the police always thought that some kind of elopement was the most likely thing, reason for her disappearance. They really seemed to think from the very early part of the investigation that Dorothy had disappeared herself.
Did her parents tell the lawyer, the Pinkertons, or the police the name or names of the young layabout men that they didn't like her associating with?
It's actually going to turn out that it's not men, it's man. And as far as I can tell, they did not.
Wow, how dumb.
No, they try to handle themselves. You'll see.
Well,
the
lawyer and the Pinkertons was handling it themselves. If you truly want to find her.
They,
and you have a suspicion.
We'll see later on that they did it themselves. The family did it. They didn't even trust John Keith to go handle this person.
That's why they're terrible.
Yeah, they are.
These are terrible people.
Probably.
They don't love her because she was smart.
They wanted to get her back. Frances, the media felt, must have had someone in mind when he's talking about this, person who's lazy. So it took them about a month. But the media finally did find their man. On February 15th, 1911, New York's Daily News broke the story that immediately raged all across the nation. They found out that the previous September 1910, so what, about a couple of months before she disappeared, Dorothy had kind of gone missing also. But really what she did was she sneaked off for a week-long love fest with a mystery man. The mystery man that Francis Arnold almost certainly had in mind when he made his statement that he did.
Okay.
So it's this classic scenario of sneaking off. Dorothy, who, by the way, again, as you know, is a 25-year-old college graduate.
Yes.
But
still, it was
the
time and place that it was.
Yeah.
I have two very good theories.
Okay. Well, hold on. Wait for
the
theories.
I'm saving them.
Okay. So Dorothy, she set up the story that she was going to visit her college friend, Theodora Bates, who lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and that she'd be spending a week or so with Theodora. At the time, Dorothy was with her family at York Harbor, Maine, at their summer house. They summered for a good chunk of the time in Maine, like a lot of those families did from there, not just for both New York and Boston did. So she says, check the train. I'm going down to Cambridge. She apparently just went a little further. She went into the big city of Boston. And there she went to the Hotel Lenox and she took a room that her secret lover had already arranged for her to take that morning. By the way, it was a room with a bath. So she registered under her own name and gave her actual address in New York City. She then spent the next week with George Jr. Griscom, who's a 42-year-old engineer from Pittsburgh that Dorothy had met while at Bryn Mawr in Philadelphia. Philadelphia is not that close to Pittsburgh, so I'm not sure why he's hanging out. Maybe he went to Philadelphia often on business. Somehow he met up with her in Bryn Mawr, and they started having a relationship. George was staying, or Griscom, he by the way, he asked people to call him Junior. That tells you a little bit about George Griscom. He was staying at a different hotel, but the two lovers were spotted partying together all over Boston for that entire week. They're, you know, having a great time.
Was he very wealthy? Was he from the same social?
He was from a wealthy family, but you'll see.
Okay.
Toward the end of the week, though, they must have been running low on money. So I don't know. He was a mama's boy. So he probably had, he was said to be an engineer. I don't think he was.
Didn't mean he was working.
No.
Okay.
And so he was kind of reliant on his family as well, at a 42-year-old man.
Yeah.
And
gross.
He, you know, had, apparently he didn't have any money. So Dorothy went to a pawn shop on Boylston Street in Boston, and she got $60 for $500 worth of her jewelry.
Jeez.
Well, you know, they give, she pawned them. Yes, she's going to hope to reclaim them eventually. I don't know how she's going to get the money. Maybe her next allowance month. I don't know.
And so, she's going to come back to Boston.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what her plan was, but they needed 60 more bucks to continue to party. And so she got it. And at the pawn shop, also gave her actual address and her actual name.
Yeah.
So they have a good another couple of days. It's been a week. She heads on back to York Harbor on the 24th of September. And her family, for a time, is none the wiser. But pawnbrokers have good memories. So when the press made Dorothy Arnold a household name and splashed her appearance also all across the country, that pawnbroker on Boylston Street recognized her.
Uh-huh.
And he called someone in the media, apparently the New York Daily News, and said he had a story to tell, or more likely a story to sell.
Yeah.
And he immediately, the newspapers in New York and elsewhere had a new prime suspect, and that was Junior Griscom.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to end now. We're in part one on that, and we'll come back with part two next, and we'll talk about Junior and why he was a suspect, and frankly, not a bad suspect, and who he was and what they did together. Then we're going to get into some of the crazy speculations out there and some of the things that happened as the investigation continued into Dorothy's whereabouts before finally we're going to get to what do we think, what are the theories, what happened to Dorothy, what are the leading theories, and what do we think finally happened to Dorothy, who, as you know, is still missing. That is going to come in part two.
And then can I tell you my theories?
Of course.
Okay, good.
Absolutely. I'm going to have to insist upon it, as a matter of fact. So thank you for listening to part one of the Dorothy Arnold disappearance.
And we'll see you next week for part two.
Okay.
Bye.